welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. Just in today, the praying football coach from Washington State who won his battle with the U.S. Supreme Court to get his job back has now resigned after just one game. We'll discuss the impacts of his fight to the Supreme Court, his rationale for leaving. I'd also tease to a possible interview with him coming up on the show this week. Also, juveniles are being sought in a disturbing string of attacks against elderly Asian Americans in Seattle. We're going to play one of the videos and play what the Seattle Police Department has to say about it, and also what they had to say to questions about whether this is a hate crime. Plus, later on, unbelievable standards of justice. We're going to talk about the sentences being handed down to individuals involved in the January 6th riot at our nation's capital. And later on, Bill Gates is betting big on Bud Light, which is a little strange. If you've not become an Undivided subscriber already, please do so. Help support our mission and our movement to give common sense a comeback. It's just $5 a month. UndividedPod.com. UndividedPod.com. All right, you will all remember Coach Joe Kennedy. He was the football coach at Bremerton High in Washington State. He ended up losing his job because he would go out to the 50-yard line after games and he would pray. And there were some parents who felt like, hey, my child might feel compelled or to go pray with him. And so it is a case that wound up in the U.S. Supreme Court, and he won. I was actually kind of surprised by. I've said from the beginning that I didn't particularly agree with the practice of Coach Kennedy going out to pray on the 50-yard line after games, given the fact it's a public school district. Separation of church and state is something I take very seriously. However, I admired his years-long efforts to fight for what he believed were his First Amendment rights. So anyway, we were anticipating his return to the sidelines at the games because of the Supreme Court ruling. And the Seattle Times pushing out the breaking news this morning, their headline, "Praying Bremerton football coach Joe Kennedy quits after one game." The article says, "Kennedy could not be reached immediately for comment. In his resignation letter obtained by the Seattle Times, he expressed dissatisfaction with the district. Quote, it is apparent that the reinstatement order by the Supreme Court will not be fully followed after a series of actions meant to diminish my role and single me out in what I can only believe is retaliation by the school district." And, you know, we hope to hear a little more detail on why, you know, this is something he'd fought for years to be able to get his job back, go back to coaching the team in Bremerton. He plays one game, opts to resign. And look, I know his life has changed a lot since all of this first started. I had an opportunity to chat with him a little bit in an event a couple months ago. And he has a lot going on nationally, and he's become this sort of figure in the freedom of religion movement. And so that certainly might have something to do with it, that, you know, his fight is just bigger than what's going on in Bremerton and bigger than his individual desire to pray at the 50-yard line. But I actually, I delivered a speech. It was to the Kitsap County Lincoln Day Dinner, and that was the speech that he was at. I encourage you to listen to it. It's up on podcast from a couple months ago. But he was sitting right in front of me during the speech, and as part of the speech, I talked about his fight to the U.S. Supreme Court, and I talked about how I wasn't in agreement with him. However, I admired his desire to fight, despite what it cost him personally and professionally, for what he thought was right. And I think the most important freedoms to fight for are the ones that you aren't necessarily exercising yourself or might not fully understand. And so I certainly can appreciate where he was coming from. I will note, we've been trying to get him on the show for a long time, Nicole. We've been like, they were going to come and then didn't. And I was like, does he hate me? And then I met him and he was perfectly wonderful. So we were also supposed to have him in today.
Tomorrow. But now he went back to Florida.
What the heck, coach?
He might be joining us via Zoom.
But so we're still working on it.
Yes.
Yeah. It'll be interesting. I hope that comes through because we've had a couple, we've had some challenges getting him on the show, but I would love to hear. And maybe it's because I've been outspoken that I don't agree with him, but he was on Dory a bunch.
Yeah,
and I know
he came on our show quite a bit, even though Dory disagreed with him as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I definitely think he knew he was going to quit. He lives in Florida now. He doesn't live in Bremerton. So yeah. Why would he stick around just to be a part-time assistant coach? And, you know, I don't know. He is doing a lot these days. But yeah, it's not really a surprise that he left. I mean, I guess there had to be a hoopla about it. You know, right. You get your job back, so you have to go take it. And apparently he prayed on the field. I think the first game was on the first. He prayed on the field after the game, and nobody came. None of the kids came out and prayed with him, but a bunch of people in the stands did.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, so maybe it was just making a point about, okay, I won and that victory is complete and I'm going to do this and I'm going to pray and then I'm going to move on, because it's been 8 years.
I know. I was going to say the kids that were out there praying with him before are no longer in school.
They don't even know him.
They've graduated college. Right.
I'm sure their minds have already been poisoned against him long before he came back in the public school system, but who knows?
Totally new staff, probably more staff. I don't know. Yes, I'm happy that this has kind of ended, though, because I think that it, I don't know. I'm glad that he fought it all the way and, you know, there's this decision made. But then at the same time, like the ups and downs of it, I thought just kind of, I don't know. It gave that fight for religion and for, it was a bad taste in my mouth.
Yeah. Yeah. And I admire what he did. I admire what he fought for. It's a victory for him. I don't necessarily agree with it. I don't have to. That's the beauty of the United States of America, is you have a right to fight for your freedoms if you feel like they're being infringed. He did, and he won. So I look forward to maybe some follow-up in what he felt like the Bremerton School District was going to do that would sort of diminish his role there. But again, it's also just fitting that he probably moved on with his life. He's in Florida. That was 8 years ago, not even the same group of kids. So, but an interesting story nonetheless, how he has just become a cultural phenomenon. So wanted to update you that on that. Coach Joe Kennedy is not going to be coaching any longer at Bremerton. He has resigned. All right. This is a story we have not touched on yet, although it has been playing out behind the scenes. And I wanted to talk about it today because the Seattle Police Department is finally addressing it in a very significant way. And now it's become this political sort of football that I'm not particularly pleased with. But there has been, since June, a string of attacks, mostly in South Seattle, against elderly Asian Americans. And they have been, some of them caught on video, really quite horrific. And the suspects are young Black males. And as I said, the victims tend to be older Asian Americans. So I'll play one of the videos. So just to give you a little context, our friend Jonathan Cho had got this video. It was from the Ring camera of the front door. There was a man, 57-year-old Dak Cobb.
Come out right now. Everything you got. Come out of everything.
It's a turn, nigga.
Take the ring over.
Come out of
everything.
You can't get it off? You can't get it off? Can't get it off.
Tased him.
Don't move.
Now I'm trying to pull a ring off his finger.
Shut up, nigga. Take the ring off.
I'm trying to.
Crying, gasping for breath. Nicole's looking at me like, why didn't you bleep the N-word? Because I didn't say it. And I wanted to show how absolutely cruel and callous those young men were after they had come up from behind, pointed a gun at his face. One of them tased him, kept that, that's an edited video, kept that taser rolling, sending shockwaves through his body. And as he's flailing on the ground, you hear the callousness of get his ring off his finger, take his ring off, as he's gasping for breath, crying out. It's disturbing to watch. And again, it goes back to this theme of, you know, if we take the racial element out of it, which we'll talk about momentarily, the mindset of these youth to have such a flagrant disregard for other human beings is something that is happening with increased frequency that is really disturbing. I think it's one of the biggest crises we're facing as a country. So again, this he's a immigrant from Vietnam. He is now facing, by the way, a $5,000 bill from Harborview after this attack. Hope to God someone pays that for him. 57 years old, I wouldn't call that elderly, but the attacks that have happened have focused on older Asian immigrants. So yesterday, the Seattle Police Department had a press conference to address this, because now there have been so many of these which are clearly being perpetrated by the same individuals. So they held a press conference and gave a little bit more details on the pattern that has emerged.
We put out information this past Friday regarding the 14 incidents that have been reported to us since the start of June. Within the month of August, we have had 8 reported incidents and this is starting from August 6th. In these pattern robberies, in terms of the suspect information, we are seeing that it's a group of 3 to 7 black males in their teens. These suspects, they are armed and they are targeting elderly Asians within our communities here within the South Precinct. In regards to these incidents, they are accosting these victims either outside of their homes or forcing entry into their homes. And this involves either assaulting them with a firearm or holding them at gunpoint and going into their homes, and they are stealing items of high value. So that could be jewelry and large amounts of cash within their residence. They are seen either arriving and or leaving the area most of the time in a Kia or Hyundai vehicle. So we are still asking the community, if they do have any information, to please give our violent crimes tip line a call, which is that 206-233-5000 phone number.
Yeah. So again, 3 to 7 black males, teenagers, usually seen driving away in a Kia or a Hyundai. What are the chances that their getaway vehicles are stolen? So clearly they are a little crime syndicate of teenagers who have done this repeatedly, around 14 times, police believe, since June, 8 times in the month of August alone, and the attacks are horrifying. I mean, all I could think about watching that man, again, an immigrant to this country from Vietnam, listening to him writhing in pain on the front doorstep, is at least I'm glad they at least didn't shoot him. And I hate to say it that way, but it's like, that's what I would expect. That's my expectation now with these young kids. They're just going to come up and shoot you to take something from you. It's just, it's really, really horrendous to watch. Now, an aspect of this that has become a little divisive, and there's disagreement on it, is whether this is a hate crime, whether these attacks are hate crimes. Black suspects, Asian victims. SPD also addressed that issue, and they were unequivocal.
We want to emphasize that we're not considering this hate crimes. We want to make sure that's very clear. They're targeting vulnerable adults in our community. And so what we're going to do and what we are doing, we're investigating and we're going to catch them. I mean, that's what's going to happen. But we want to make sure that, you know, we know and the public knows that this is not a hate crime. This is people that are trying to attack our vulnerable adults in our community. And so with that, I'm going to open up some questions.
How do you know it's not a hate crime?
Well, hate crimes are targeted against people because of their ethnicity. And this is more about people that they think are easy targets. And that's what we're finding so far.
I don't get it. So I'm torn on this because I don't like when things are just automatic, like, oh, hate crime, hate crime, hate crime, whenever it happens against a person of color. But he just said that hate crimes are something that's targeting someone based on their ethnicity, and you're telling us that they're being targeted because they're immigrants, because they're Asians, they're all elderly Asian Americans. And we know that sometimes people will victimize immigrants in particular because there's a fear that they might not report to police. I mean, it is that fear that Seattle city leaders have said is the reason why they consider themselves a sanctuary city, because they don't want immigrants to be fearful about going to the police if they're victimized over crimes. So it seems like the immigration status, or perhaps their lack of proficiency in English or whatever it might be what is causing these young black males to target them. And yes, their vulnerability or their perceived vulnerability. But in my mind, I just think, well, that seems targeted to me. That seems targeted on the basis of race. And I also have to wonder that if these were same exact scenario, same exact situation, but the perpetrators were white and the victims were black, young white kids targeting elderly black people, I tend to think that that would be labeled a hate crime out of the gate without question. Now, again, I'm open to the possibility that it's not a hate crime. I don't like when that's just the default, but I don't know why they're giving these violent criminals the benefit of the doubt to say, oh, no, it's not a hate crime. Like, that's kind of weird, isn't it? It seems very, very strange to me. But I also, you know, there are members of the community in South Seattle who say that they feel like it's a hate crime. And maybe that's the only way that they think they can get attention to it is if they call it a hate crime. And then all of a sudden, the pandering politicians in Seattle be like, oh, it's a hate crime? Oh, okay, we care about it now. So a little wrinkle to this. It's become kind of a political football, which Some of this feels a little performative to me. However, I can appreciate what they're trying to do. So yesterday, Seattle City Councilwoman Sarah Nelson, who's one of the good ones, she held a press conference in Tammy Morales' district. So Tammy Morales, who's up for re-election, is the councilwoman for District 2, South Seattle, Chinatown International District. And her district is where a lot of the gang shootings are happening. It's where this stuff is happening. It's where a lot of the homelessness and substance abuse is happening. And members of her community have been complaining for a year that she's not doing anything. She's not present. She's not there for them. In fact, I think it was just a few days ago, there was a African-American Advisory Council meeting or something like that, where they were just, and she was at, they were just absolutely going after her because she's just not there for the community. So anyway, Sarah Nelson, this is not her district, but she held a press conference down in D2. This is from Chris Daniels with Como TV. He said, stunning display from a sitting Seattle council member. Sarah Nelson asks, where is Tammy Morales? Nelson, standing in Little Saigon, says she needs four pro-public safety council members or, quote, nothing will change. And notably, Tanya Wu, who is challenging Tammy Morales in that district, was there and was invited to it. And Tammy Morales, rather than, I don't know, come out and say, hey, here's what I've been doing for the Asian American community. Here's what I've been doing to help with public safety. She responds, retweets that and says, for the record, I was not invited to this campaign event for my opponent. My question for Sarah is, why were you campaigning instead of attending our transportation committee? So her response is just snarky. When again, people are dying in your district, Councilwoman. The gang shootings are happening in your district. Not only are they being perpetrated by young men, the victims are young men of color who you have pretended to care about. And you have members of the Asian American community who are very literally being hunted down by criminals in at least 14 instances that we know of that have been reported to police since June. So rather than the smartass remarks, where are you at? Why aren't you in the transportation meeting? Give us some information about what you've been doing. Help voters understand if you feel like this is an unfair attack on you, that you're actually doing a lot to help with public safety, enumerate that for us. Let us know what you've been up to. But you're not going to because you haven't been up to jack. And your district, more than any other, needs a pro-public safety council person. And that's what Sarah Nelson was down there saying, because she's had enough of putting up common sense policies and having people like you smack them down while you pretend to care about the people in your district and their health and their happiness and their safety. It's absolutely ridiculous. We need to get Tanya Wu on the show. Nicole, note that. Let's invite Tanya Wu on the show. But this is, I mean, it's horrifying what's happening. Obviously, police are aware that it's a pattern, who they're looking out for. I tend to be skeptical of their emphasis on it absolutely not being a hate crime, because I think if the races of people involved were different, we might be talking about it a little bit differently. So that seems very, very weird to me. But, you know, as much as it's a little bit of political showmanship for Sarah Nelson to go down to Tammy Morales' district during all of this and talk about public safety, I don't blame her, because she's right. Unless they have a total of five council members who value life, who value common sense and public safety, then nothing in the city of Seattle is going to change. And that starts, I think, really in District 2, because Tammy Morales is the most fringe of all of them, and she supports policies that take it easy on criminals, and she opposes policies that would help make her community less safe. That would help make her community more safe. So we will keep our eye on that one. I know our friend Jonathan Cho has been covering this string of attacks very extensively. And so if there's any major updates, we'll ask him to hop on and update everyone. All right, coming up next, we're going to play a clip from Sundays with Subscribers this week. We talked to King County, speaking of youth violence, we talked to King County Councilman Girmay Zahalai. He represents the district on the King County Council where a lot of these shootings have been happening, a lot of these acts of violence. And I asked him, okay, what do you think can be done to deter these young people from a life of crime? So I'm going to play a clip from that coming up next. But first, we've been talking about Wes Jones, a wonderful real estate agent in our area. If you're thinking about selling your home and you're kind of hearing different things about the state of the market, pay him a visit at sellwithwes.com, because he can offer some honest advice about what's going on and can talk to you about what he and his team can do for you. We've talked about the Listing Boost concierge service, where they come in, they can take care of any updates and renovations you need for your home. You can even pay at closing. It's something that Susan in Federal Way took advantage of when she was trying to sell the home she'd lived in for 25 years.
I knew I had to paint, I knew I needed to get new flooring. I needed to get new lighting. I told him up front that I was very interested, that I did not have the time or the finances to do what needed to be done. And he immediately jumped in with, well, I do. Work started immediately. And I would say in 2 to 3 weeks, they had landscaping done. They had all the painting done. The new floors were put in. All the lighting was put in. It just was all so fast. And the rest is history. It was on the market for 7 days. I was able to get well over listing price.
To be specific, Susan got 20 offers, sold it for 15% over list price, and ended up getting $200,000 more than an investor offered her before the renovations. $200,000 more just by going to sellwithwest.com and talking to them about the Listing Boost Concierge Service. I think that's awesome. So if you're in the market to sell your home, visit sellwithwest.com. Sellwithwest.com, you can start by simply using their home value calculator to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. Sellwithwest.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, we've been talking about this theme of youth violence. What the heck is happening to our young people? I tend to believe that a big part of it is they are not being held accountable for what they're doing. How many of these stories have we talked about? People who steal cars, who do hit and runs, who assault law enforcement officers, allegedly being cut free without bail and not returning to answer for their crimes. I mean, what message does that send? There's a reason why you have young people committing crimes so brazenly. They don't think anything is going to happen to them. Even if they get arrested, they don't think anything is going to happen to them. So anyway, there was a really horrible, horrible shooting in Seattle last month at a hookah lounge. And 6 people total were shot. 3 of them died, including a 30-year-old woman named Nadia Casa. And she was just an innocent bystander who was at the hookah lounge, was not involved in what was believed to be a gang feud, and she lost her life. And she's actually the sister of a staff member to King County Councilman Jeremiah Zahalai, who came out on Twitter and has really started to talk more and more about the need to end some of this violence that's happening on the streets. And he joined us for Sundays with Subscribers, and we had an interesting conversation. I disagree with him on a lot of things about the criminal justice system, but one point he made is, and I tend to agree, that we need to focus more on what is a relatively small group of young people who are responsible for a vast majority of the violent crime that's happening in his district. You know, and we talked about how you can ban assault weapons and do all these things that make flashy headlines, but it's not really getting at the root of the problem and the root of what's causing and who's responsible for a majority of the shootings and a majority of the violence. And I agree with him wholeheartedly. So we talked about, okay, if we want to focus in on what happens to be a relatively small group of mostly young Black men who are involved in the gang life, what can be done? Here is a part of that conversation, again, that aired this past Sunday on Sundays with Subscribers. I wonder what you think your role can be or how you can message to your district and to young men in particular about how they will be held accountable, about how, you know, there are consequences for violent behavior.
I would first and foremost show people the devastating impacts that these shootings have on people's lives. Every shooting that happens, every death that happens, the story doesn't end with the death, even if the media attention for that specific family is. That surviving family has to live with those consequences forever. Each of my staff, once there is a shooting, we are supporting a surviving family. And it takes almost my entire one of my staff members to help just one family. And so you see our ability to respond and to help families diminishing over time because there are so many shootings, so many families to take care of. And I would just ask people to think about, what does it mean for that family to not see their child again? What does it mean for that spouse to not have the love of their life with them anymore? What does it mean for those children? The Soto Uber driver, 2 kids now don't have a dad. That is just devastating. And I want people to look at that and think about that before they make that decision.
But what if they can't relate to that message? I would argue that someone who is willing to pick up a gun, shoot it, you know, into a busy club, shoot it at a moving vehicle, out of a moving vehicle, how many innocent kids have we seen shot in drive-by shootings? To me, I don't see that message resonating with them.
Yeah, I think that's right, especially in the social media era where so many of these young people are, before one insult was just to one person. Now that insult has an audience of thousands of people. And so people are hyping each other up. They feel like their reputations are on the line if they don't react. And that's why I think that we need these hyper-focused intervention strategies. It's going to be, you need a person who has trust and respect and more trust between themselves and the person who's most likely to shoot in order to intervene.
But don't you think it also might be helpful if they're scared to hell, scared about going to prison?
I honestly don't know. You know, we've had these shootings for decades, and our criminal justice policy has morphed over time. And I don't know that we've seen more shootings lockstep with changing criminal justice policy. I've seen a huge spike in shootings since a huge disruption in government operations and huge staffing shortages since the pandemic. That's what I see. But I don't know. I don't see a change in behavior because, you know, there are more diversion programs. I don't see increased violence because there are more diversion programs, if that's the implication.
Yeah, I just worry that we're teaching kids that there aren't consequences for their behavior. You know, and there was a story you were involved with back in, I think it was September of 2020, where there was a protest on Queen Anne turned into a riot. One of the kids grabbed something, hit a guy, an innocent bystander in the back of the head, gave him a concussion and 3 stitches. And you showed up at that kid's 27 years old. You know, he's charged with assault in the second degree. You showed up at his arraignment and said, hey, let him go without bail. I'll be accountable for him. And so just on a personal level, I mean, how does that show accountability? How does that teach accountability for violent behavior?
I think it just connects people to a form of support and a form of response that is tailored to the specific person who is going through something. And that's why they did whatever they did. Oftentimes what I see is a young person goes to jail, they are traumatized there, they are afraid there, whatever mental health condition that they had is exacerbated there, they get out, they're unable to get a job, they're unable to redirect their life toward the positive. And I see this devolving dynamic where they're more likely to do a shooting, they're more likely to live on the street. They're more likely to be in an encampment because of our criminal legal system. And so we just have to think about what is best on a case-by-case basis for each individual.
And you can watch that full, nearly 1 hour conversation with King County Councilman Girmay Zahalai about what we can do to try to stop some of the violence that's happening, mostly by youth who are involved in gangs in South Seattle. I'll just say about what he said there at the end. You know, I obviously disagree fundamentally with the notion that, you know, punishing people for crimes they've already committed, that we have to be concerned that that would make it more likely for them to commit other crimes, and how are they going to get a job, and they might end up in an encampment. Well, if they hurt someone, what about the person who they hurt? What about the person they victimized? What about the person who they killed? I mean, at that stage where they've already committed a crime, I feel like what we need to be focused on is way, way before they've already committed a crime. By the time they've committed a crime, they have to pay for that crime, or else you are telling them that there aren't consequences for their behavior, and that's leading to this lawlessness that we're seeing right now. Now, you know, you hear folks like Girmay Zahalai, and I think a lot of the folks on the, you know, defund sort of side of things, or reimagining rather policing in the criminal justice system. You hear them talk a lot about, okay, funding programs that are going to help youth, you know, divert them out of gangs, or give them something else besides that life. And I agree with those things. I think that's really important. You know, teaching kids skills around financial literacy from a young age so they have other avenues that they can take rather than the cheap and violent way to make money, just as an example. But I also worry, as we focus more and more on that, is, okay, if we're going to throw money at it, who's making sure that that money is actually being used to good effect? I mean, look what's happened with the homelessness crisis. Like 10 years ago, they started talking about, oh, we need to throw more programs and more outreach and stuff to make sure that people aren't homeless and they get off the streets. And what do we have now? We have a multi-billion-dollar homeless industrial complex and a worse homeless crisis than we've ever had before. And so I can just see the same thing happening when you're talking about trying to end youth detention, or, you know, decrease youth detention, which in theory theory, we should all agree with that in a perfect flowery world. But we've already seen that in some of these organizations and nonprofits who've gotten funding from the government, especially in 2020, that they have had virtually no oversight. And there are some groups who are demanding audits of them. But because it's involved in race and social justice, it's like, oh no, we can't look into how they're spending their money. And there was one high profile example where thankfully the woman did get caught, and she actually just got sentenced. This is the article from the Seattle Times. Finance director of two Seattle nonprofits sentenced for embezzlement. Her name is Susanna Tontico. We talked about this story back when she was convicted. She pled guilty to two counts of wire fraud. She embezzled money from Country Doctor Community Health Centers and Community Passageways, which is sort of a high-profile race and social justice initiative in Seattle that has been under scrutiny. She stole, within 4 years, nearly $2.3 million, withdrew over $1.5 million from the organization's accounts at casinos, and spent tens of thousands at Nordstrom's and Apple stores. I mean, for the love, and this is, again, just one example, but there have been several nonprofits that, again, got taxpayer money at the height of the protests over race and social justice. And I think back to the Street Czar. You know, that Seattle hired, basically it was because they were bribing him to try to help him end Chaz Chop. So they gave him a lucrative contract with the city to be the Street Czar, to connect criminals with police and try to build bridges. And what happened? Well, they didn't renew the contract after 6 months because he didn't do anything. And so, you know, I'm all for the concept, the idea of helping these kids get on a better path long before they get down the wrong one. I am not okay with throwing money at the problem that isn't highly, highly scrutinized, just as I would expect from any other type of government spending. We've seen what happened with the homeless crisis. We don't need a repeat of that, because what will happen is in 10 years, we'll have spent tens of billions of dollars and we'll have more young people committing crimes than ever before. All right, coming up next, we'll get to our segment, Unbelievable. I got to talk about some of the sentences being handed down to individuals who participated in the riot on January 6th. My opinion on this matter might not be popular, but we've got to discuss it. First, I've been talking about my friends at Firstmark Insurance. Mike and I took the Firstmark Challenge in the spring. We are now proud members of the Firstmark family. I've heard so many success stories from those of you who have also taken the Firstmark Challenge and either are getting exceptionally better insurance, better service, or a better price, or all of the above. Here's Dave Taylor. He's the CEO of Firstmark, talking about what the Firstmark Challenge is all about.
We believe and we say that we will help 100% of the people that we work with. Okay. Now that doesn't mean necessarily that 100% of the people we work with are going to become Firstmark clients, but we believe that we will actually help 100% of the people, whether that be stay with your current carrier, but let's modify your coverage a bit so you're better protected, or ultimately, hopefully come over to Firstmark. We're going to put you with a different company and give you better coverage, right? So the challenge is really challenging individuals to give us an opportunity to prove that to them. That's really what the Firstmark challenge is.
Yeah, no matter what, you're going to walk away with something, either knowledge, a better insurance, a better price where you're saving money, which I know can be helpful right now with budgets stretched thin, and it's free. So you're really just investing a little bit of time and the outcome can be great for you. So firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com, take the Firstmark challenge. They work for you. Okay, let's see. Yeah, we'll move on to our segment, Unbelievable. There have been some whopper sentences handed down for individuals who were involved in the January 6th Capitol riot. Let's talk about it in Unbelievable. All right, you guys hear me wax poetic all the time about law and order, about respect for the rule of law, about making sure that criminals are accountable for their crime. My opinion on that matter does not change based on the politics, based on the skin color, based on any other characteristic of the person involved besides what did they do, what were they convicted of, and what sort of sentence seems like justice. I have said that January 6th was a national embarrassment, and I really don't care if people who were involved in it spend time in prison, particularly those individuals who assaulted police officers or tried to actually make an effort to stop certification of the presidential election. But some of these sentences that are coming down really have my mind thinking overtime. So let's just click through a couple of them, shall we? Enrique Tarrio got 22 years in prison. He was deemed to be the ultimate leader of the conspiracy to stop the certification of the election. Kyle Fitzsimmons got 7 years, accused or convicted of assaulting officers. Again, you know, do the crime, do the time. Let's see. Seattle guy Ethan Nordine got 18 years. Led the group's march on Congress, was sentenced to 18 years for a seditious conspiracy. Dominic Pizzola got 10 years. He fought with officers and smashed a window of the Capitol in with a police riot shield. Let's see. Joseph Biggs, seditious conspiracy and an act of terrorism, 17 years. Zachary Rell, 15 years, accused of convicted of shooting a canister of chemical spray at officers who were trying to protect the Capitol building. Yeah, so look, do the crime, do the time. Like, I'm sorry, I'm not going to defend you just because I, in some instances, think 22 years seems like an awful lot. However, when I think about some of the cases we've been talking about recently, I just am stunned by, I think, an unbelievable standard of justice. I think back to the Chaz Chop situation. And people who took an entire police precinct hostage, who shot, you know, firebombs at it, tried to light it on fire with officers inside, people who lit construction trailers on fire at the youth jail in Seattle, people who burned police cars in downtown Seattle, who rioted and who looted, who assaulted police officers, who assaulted journalists. And the vast majority of those people were never even identified and arrested. And I have to believe that, you know, the level of police work, obviously, that went into identifying the people involved in January 6th was much more vast. But the people who were arrested, and some of them were, and some of them were convicted in federal trials and ended up getting several years in prison. But nothing even remotely close to 7 years, 17 years, 15 years, 22 years. And again, we can have an argument all day over what's more serious, you know, destroying a downtown, taking over a police precinct, or trying to stop certification of a presidential election and laying siege on the nation's capital. I'm not going to have that back and forth. I think that there are things to be deeply mortified and embarrassed about with both of them. Now, one of them got a lot of political cover from the left. The other one got a lot of political cover from people on the right. And to me, it all just reeks of hypocrisy. However, the one thing that I cannot get out of my head over all of this is the case we talked about on the show 2 weeks ago, Wendy Traynor. I can't get it out of my head every time I see one of these January 6th sentences, how the man who shot her in the back of the head in Milton in 2017 is about to be sentenced to 7 years in prison for shooting someone in the back of the head in an act of domestic violence. 7 years. And then you got people who stormed the Capitol. And again, fine, rotten prison for all I care, who are getting way more than that, who never killed anyone, and in some instances never actually caused physical harm to anyone. And the guy who murdered Wendy Traynor in cold blood gets a sweetheart plea deal for 7 years. I can't get it out of my head. It is not, it makes no sense. The standard of justice makes no sense. And we think of all these plea deals being handed down to individuals who commit heinous crimes, take people's lives, change their lives forever, and their sentences aren't anywhere close to 22 years. It's just something I was thinking about. Nicole, am I wrong in my assessment of that? I'm not saying the J6ers need to have more lenient sentences. I'm saying in comparison,
right,
that no, there are some individuals who commit violent, violent crimes in this country, and they get off with a slap on the wrist.
Right. And if there's some violent crimes, some, you know, crimes on other people, like stealing, attacking, whatever, all of these crimes that are getting less time than this, which a lot of those guys, I mean, yes, that was a terrible day and they did terrible things that day. However, in their real lives, they're like dads and husbands, and
well, I don't care about that.
I'm just saying, but if you're gonna argue for people to not spend time in jail because It's not doing anything for society to pay for these people to be in jail. Right. And, you know, what they do outside, or, you know, let these people out that are committing violent crimes and crimes on other people constantly and show no remorse.
Right.
It doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make any sense.
So I get it. Yes, they did terrible things. But, like, maybe there's another way for them to repay their debt to society.
Right.
As opposed to just letting out murderers.
Well, what about all the, mass incarceration and putting people in prison doesn't help anything, except if they're Donald Trump supporters and they stormed the Capitol. Right. But I also go back to and this is kind of the comparison I've used to paint a lot of Seattle's hypocrisy around these issues. If it had been Trump supporters who took over 6 square blocks of Seattle, including a police precinct, handed out AR-15s and AK-47s to random strangers to patrol the streets out of the trunk of a car, assaulted police officers, assaulted journalists, mobbed a journalist who had to seek refuge in a fire station. Does anyone really think that a single one of them would have gone unidentified? Or that a single city council member would have stayed silent on it?
Right.
They would still be talking about it today, and they would point to it to excuse every other act of violence that the left perpetrates in Seattle from now until the end of time, because they'd be like, oh, well, look what the right wingers did up at Chaz Chop back in 2020.
Right.
It's unreal to me. And people who cannot see the hypocrisy in that, it's something I talked to Gurmai Zahalai about on the Sunday show. I said, you know, here he is talking about guns and gun control. I said, you didn't say anything. Neither did any city council member when they were handing out your weapons of war out of the trunk of a car to people who they didn't even know how old they were.
I know. He said he didn't say anything.
He goes, oh, I didn't see that.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to take it. He seems like an honest man. And he said, I wouldn't support that. But that is the peak of hypocrisy.
Everyone knew guns were there. Everyone knew there was nobody patrolling, they didn't have guns.
They had checkpoints.
Yeah.
It's the height of hypocrisy. And I got, I was on, I think it was the last time I was invited on KOW's Week in Review, which is the NPR station in Seattle. And it's like, they'll do a panel of 3 journalists and they'll discuss the week's events. And I got absolutely, the other 2 journalists ganged up on me for the mere suggestion that yes, January 6th was serious. However, where were all of you guys when we went through the quote unquote summer of love? Why weren't we treating that? Political violence is political violence. We need to treat it with the seriousness it deserves, or I just cannot take you seriously when you talk about you're just aghast at January 6th, unless you've also been aghast at what was an incredibly serious, dangerous, and deadly summer in Seattle.
Yeah.
Would not have been treated the same in any realm had it been Republicans, had it been Trump supporters. And that will always bother me to the core. And forgive me if it bothers me to the core that Wendy Traynor's killer is going to get 7 years while individuals who stormed the Capitol are getting 22 years, 15 years plus.
Right. No, I'm just as frustrated as you.
Truly unbelievable.
Yeah. I just don't get it.
You know, if only we could.
But, you know, I mean, if I was seeing all of this, I mean, I'd be a little bit nervous if I was Trump.
Oh, I didn't even think
of that. All of these things, I'm like, no, I don't know.
Yeah.
Nobody's going easy on these guys.
Yeah, I do, though, have to laugh about people who are like, nonviolent crimes, you know, we don't want people rotting in prison. That's not good. Trump supporters, 22 years.
Right, exactly.
Love it. They should have gotten life. You know, I don't know if anybody's saying they should have gotten life.
It'll be really interesting if a Republican can win the next election, what happens to all of these people.
I would be upset if they got pardoned. Just as I would be
surprised,
upset.
Though?
Maybe not surprised.
Not surprised.
But just like I'd be upset if somebody pardoned the people who burned down Seattle and attacked officers, the very few who did face consequences for their actions. No, you assault a police officer like some of these individuals do, you deserve to go to federal prison. I said that from the very beginning. Now, as far as seditious conspiracy, we can have agreements back and forth. But what they did was wrong. If it had been BLM rioters who took to the Capitol over something, over Donald Trump, if Donald Trump had won, it had been BLM people or something.
However,
or the left
none of
wing.
Those people were
right.
prosecuted that, either.
That's what I'm saying is like, it's we have to be morally consistent on violence, regardless of what end of the spectrum perpetrates it. But anyway,
it's just kind of crazy how these judges are. I mean, it's all politics.
Right.
Everybody's got a Nobody can put it aside.
No.
It really seems like.
And I just get more enraged by the day as we approach the October 20th sentencing for Wendy Traynor's killer, because every time I see a sentence, I'm like, well, why can't he get that sentence? Anyway, I digress. Okay, let's get to some national news quickly. Bill Gates. Well, I guess it's the Bill and Melinda Gates Fund. Which it's interesting,
yeah,
they still have names linked together. So the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Trust bought $1.7 million of shares in Anheuser-Busch. This is so fascinating to me. So the way CNN paints it, Bill Gates made a nearly $100 million bet on Bud Light, and they painted this as, you know, sort of, oh, well, he's betting that all this outrage over the Dylan Mulvaney thing is going to fade, and maybe he's buying low and hoping to sell high. But the buy was about $95 million. CNN says it signals that Gates has confidence in the beer company that has been dealing with a steep sales slump of one of its biggest beers. And he bought that stock, by the way, at a time when the losses were fully realized. So it wasn't like he bought it and then it was like, oh God, Dylan Mulvaney happened. No, it was after. So I'm very curious if this was like more of a political point. I know it's not him, like individually, like, if it's more of a political point to say, we're going to prop up this company that supported Dylan Mulvaney, or if they really are like just being business people and assuming, hey, it's going to bounce back. This is going to be short-lived. So we're going to dump a bunch of money in and then hopefully make a ton on the back end, which is possible. But I just don't see the Bud Light thing.
Or you know somebody. I mean, Bud Light has some very high executives, very a lot of money in there. And I would think that he probably knows some of those people that are tied to the company. And maybe he's all for helping it survive, because there are a lot of people that will be hurt if it crashes, or if it goes away completely, I guess. And it's already crashed.
Yeah, well, but they do more than Bud Light.
I think he could be trying to save it.
Possibly. They do more than Bud Light. I was just looking at Anheuser-Busch's website.
Oh, yeah.
Their beers, Budweiser, Bud Light, Mick Ultra, which my uncle loves a good Michelob Ultra. I'm sure he's still drinking them. Stella, Busch, Natty Ice.
Well, Michelob is now the highest selling beer. Like, people don't even realize they're all connected.
I thought it was the...
Oh, wait, Modelo.
Maybe it was Modelo.
Yeah.
Which is a good beer. I don't like beer.
But I still think that only those two top brands are probably taking the heat of most of the protesting. But yeah, they're behind a lot. I think everybody would notice if they went away completely, because you probably consume more of their products than you think.
Yeah. Good point.
So I think that he's probably trying to save it. That would be
my guess.
Why don't
you invest the entirety of your savings in Anheuser-Busch and let us know what happens?
Okay, $5 right now.
Let us know what happens. Okay.
Will do.
All right. A story out of the southern border that I think is common sense. Again, I have to clear my throat. Hold on. Clear my throat with espresso, which is the only thing I have on hand to drink. So we talked about this a few days ago with Bob Ferguson, how, you know, they want to condemn some sort of issue and fix some sort of issue and pontificate that they really care about it, but their actions just don't line up. I mean, that was the case with him with the fentanyl crisis, which is he did everything he could to sue Donald Trump as many times as he could to prevent the southern border from getting more secure. I mean, all number of lawsuits. He never spoke out about some of the really disastrous, dangerous public safety policies his own party was pushing that made Washington State a safe haven for drug cartel. And now he wants to write a letter to the federal government saying, hey, we need help with the fentanyl crisis. And then, oh, puke today. We even pull this. The Seattle Times editorial board wrote another glowing op-ed. Nicole, the Seattle Times editorial board, I didn't put this in. They wrote another glowing op-ed about Bob Ferguson.
Of course they did.
That they published today about how his actions on the fentanyl crisis are praiseworthy. And I tweeted at him. I'm like, you guys have to be kidding me. You have to be kidding me. But anyway, so one of the issues we hear a lot of people on both sides of the aisle, politicians talking about, is human trafficking, right? How that's obviously, that's not political. We don't want young people to be human trafficked into forced labor or into sex labor. I mean, that's horrifying. And politicians of all stripes will claim that they care about ending the scourge of human trafficking. But then the Biden administration ended the DNA family testing that had been implemented at the southern border to make sure that when you've got children and a parent, quote unquote, that it's actually that person's child. And that it's not a drug cartel bringing a child across the border to sell them into sex slavery and saying, yeah, this is my kid. So the Biden administration ended the DNA testing. which some people are pointing out is incredibly dangerous and incredibly contrary to anyone saying that they want to end the scourge of human trafficking. So Jim Desmond, he's a supervisor in the 5th District for the San Diego County Board of Supervisors. He sent a letter to the Biden administration saying the reports of individuals fraudulently claiming children as their own and subsequently separating them from their true guardians are harrowing and unacceptable. This inhumane practice must be brought to an immediate halt through the reinstatement of DNA testing. And this is one of those things where I fail to see the controversy in it. I fail to see why there would be any political division when it comes to a surefire way to make sure that a child being brought across the southern border, be it through a legal point of entry where they're seeking asylum or they're caught coming through illegally across the southern border, I fail to see the controversy in making sure that that child actually belongs to that adult. And if that means that there has to be a brief period of separation, then so be it. Isn't that worth making sure that child isn't going to be brought into the U.S. and sold to some creep as a sex slave? Now, that doesn't mean you have to have prolonged periods of family separation. It doesn't mean you can't expedite to the fullest extent possible, making sure that you're not separating a parent from their actual child for longer than is necessary. But you also have to keep in mind, these people, in many of these cases, are crossing the border illegally. And so what? They just expect to be able to do that. And then, you know, there are no inconveniences for them once they get across to the other side. That's ridiculous. And again, I fail to see the divisiveness in it. So hopefully the Biden administration is going to change course on that, because we should all be, shouldn't be like a political issue to make sure kids aren't being victimized or sold into sex slavery. I just don't understand this place that we've come to as a country. All right, questions and comments from the live stream coming up next. Also a correction someone offered that I will read. But first, I've been talking about Eastside Weight Loss Clinic, my success on the program. I just had another friend started a couple days ago. They're already seeing fantastic results. I think, in fact, they said they were down 11 pounds in 6 days or something, which is great. The first 2 weeks of the program, you're like, oh my God, look at this. You step it on the scale, just celebrating every day. I'm down more than 35 pounds in the program. Absolutely feeling fantastic in time for my wedding, which is great. If you've been thinking about it, you've been hearing me read the ads for Eastside Weight Loss Clinic since January, give it a try and start by simply doing a free 15-minute consultation. It just, again, takes 15 minutes, totally free. You can talk to Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team and ask them any questions that you might have before you commit to it. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com, EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. All right, let's see here. One correction and then I'll read comments. Why is my throat? I need water. Okay, Mugshot Espresso reminded me Sarah Nelson is an at-large council member, which is true, because I said she's not even in her district, but technically everywhere is her quote-unquote district because she's one of the two citywide positions. So she had every right to be down in the Little Saigon talking about these issues. Okay, let's see here. On the coach. Oh, on Coach Joe Kennedy. Bunky says, hi, Bunky. I've never heard that name on our comments before, I don't think. Brandy, why do you object to the coach? I object. I believe firmly in the separation of church and state. And I think that if you allow one person to practice their religion, you know, on the 50-yard line, he's there as a public employee, as a school employee at a public school. I did believe and agree with the sentiment that some kids might feel compelled to have to go out and pray with them for playing time or whatever it is. And I think about, okay, what's the slippery slope? If you let him do it, do you have to let like the Satanists go out there and draw a little pentagram or something with their little candles after the games? I just think that it always, whenever you allow a bit of religion into something, it's a slippery slope. So that's just my opinion on the matter. However, like I said, and I talked to him about this in person, I admire his desire and commitment to fight for what he thought was right. And he won. So good for him. On the attacks on elderly Asians in South Seattle, Brett says, if these were young white guys, it would be labeled automatically as a hate crime. I tend to agree. Let's see. Crafty Grandma Crispy says it may depend on the definition of hate crime. If they're only being assaulted and not robbed, then they might consider it a hate crime. That's interesting. I don't know if that, does it have to be, I'd have to look at the hate crime statute if it has to be some sort of physical altercation, but I don't think it would matter if they're assaulted and robbed. I think that if you're assaulting and robbing someone, that can absolutely be a hate crime, if you're doing it for the reason.
Right, but if you're just assaulting somebody for the sake of assaulting, then it comes off as more of a hate crime.
Oh,
if you're
robbing, I see, yeah.
Then you have a different intent.
Right, so I'm just like, what? I get it now. I get it. What is the intent, right? Is the intent to steal something for you, or is the intent just to hurt you because I don't like the color of your skin? So that is a very good point. Casey said, the people that vote for more moderate or conservative politicians are moving out of King County. Seattle won't change. Worried that's the case. Teresa says, some of those kids have experienced friends or family being shot. They don't care about that. They are lazy, want quick money, rapper lifestyles, and know there aren't many consequences right now. Right now is the best time to be a Grimaldi? Is that a gang?
I don't know.
Nicole, you're always putting stuff in here that I don't know what it is.
Sometimes I think you might know and I don't.
Hold on. Now I'm going to Google it. And then I just sound like an idiot. House of Grimaldi, the current reigning house of the Principality of Monaco. I doubt that's it. Is it a gang? Someone tell me. I don't know. Or maybe it's just
maybe
an error.
Maybe we don't want to know.
Okay. Matthew says, the root cause is having kids as a teenager, no father in the house, and not graduating from high school, regardless of race. I mean, I do think it does a lot of it boil down to socioeconomic status and a lack of, or a perceived lack of opportunities. And I do think that's something that we need to address, but I think there's a lot of reasons that can lead to a perceived lack of opportunities, because there's a lot of people I know who grew up poor who have done very well for themselves through commitment and hard work and not being dragged down by what happened in their past and using that as a motivation. So there's a lot of factors in why someone would feel like, wow, I can't lift myself up in the greatest country on earth, and so I have to victimize other people to make a living.
So Teresa says it was supposed to be criminal. Oh. It just misspelled. We were
all like, I don't know.
Why do we not know?
The Grimaldi. But now you guys know that Grimaldi is the current reigning house of the Principality of Monaco. And one day that'll be like a question on Jeopardy. And you'll be there and it'll be for like $50,000 bucks. And you'll be like, oh my God, now this. I remember. All right, let's see. Two Ladies Midwest Adventure says, I'm curious with the breakdown in schools being a root cause of this too. I definitely think the indoctrination in schools and the wussification of children has something to do with it.
Making them feel very entitled. They're entitled.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't matter how hard they work. It doesn't matter, what they do to earn something.
Right.
They're entitled to it.
Yeah, and we were just talking about this movement toward no fail. You can't fail a kid.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, they failed. What do you want me to do? So that definitely has something to do with it. Bill Biz with a $20 super chat. You know, Bill, I've been meaning to tell you. You need to just become a presidential patron, because there's all these benefits that come with being a presidential patron, and I think you're spending about that much anyway.
But maybe he wants his voice heard.
Look, I'm not complaining. I'm not complaining, but our presidential patronship is $250 a month, and you get to come to a fun exclusive event, which I believe will be happening at the end of October, although we haven't announced a date yet. So I'm just letting you know. He says, it's unfortunate that council members like Gurmai tend to intellectualize and obfuscate the obvious problems of violent crime. How about a little more pragmatism? Yeah, and like I told him, I mean, our interview, we talked about a lot of things. But it's like, one of the things that he denied, I said, wouldn't it help if there were more police officers out actively patrolling? Because, like, if you're going to commit a crime and you see a cop on a corner or a cop driving by, don't you think common sense tells you you might not do it at that moment in time? And so I do think that's a deterrent. And he sort of disagreed with that. And I thought, how could you disagree with that? Like, if I'm going to hurt someone, but I see a cop, I'm probably not going to hurt someone.
Yeah, except for now we're to the point where it doesn't matter because they've, made the cops unable to act on these things.
Well, yeah,
they can hurting someone.
You hurt someone.
But the punishment is nothing.
Right. I agree. Okay. And actually, I'm going to talk about that very issue coming up in Sanity Check. Todd Welch said, great questions for Ferguson. Why did the state not charge Chaz Chop gun providers since Seattle King County didn't? If you want to end gun violence, why not the state go after them? He never said anything.
Nothing.
That's what I go by. So Seattle Times editorial board, I hope one of you is listening. I think you do much better than your newsroom at actually being fair. However, you've been letting me down a lot lately. After Bob Ferguson's office had all these stories about lack of transparency, trying to hide information from people, you run an op-ed praising him for his transparency with campaign donations. After this story I mentioned last week with fentanyl, how he hasn't done jack when it comes to helping the fentanyl crisis on a public safety front, you publish an op-ed today praising him for writing a letter to Merrick Garland? He wrote a letter, like he hasn't done anything. He's made the crisis worse because he doesn't have the political will to speak out about it. And then with his key issue is gun control. That's his banner that he flies everywhere, as we banned weapons of war. You didn't say jack when they were handing weapons of war out of the trunk of a car up in the occupied protest zone. And you could do what Jay Inslee said, and he said, oh, I haven't heard about that. And you can claim, I haven't heard about that. But we know that you did. And you only stand up for things when it's politically palatable to your base and when there's a political bend to help you advance your career. That makes you a coward. And for the Seattle Times editorial board to be praising you for bare minimum things is absolutely ridiculous. All right, on January 6th, I'm gearing up for this. T.C. Burton says, New York City lawyers got 1 year for firebombing a police car, didn't lose their law license. See what I mean? Mm-hmm. Let's see. Crafty Grandma says, justice is no longer blind. It looks at your political affiliation and DEI eligibility. Leah, as much as I wrestle with the idea of leaving Washington State, this is a national issue. You can't escape the leftist ideology. You can fight against it. And that's what all of us are trying to do. Independent, many united. Is that the independent, many united? Mm-hmm. Brandy, you are way off about J6. Many who, quote, assaulted officers were trying to protect people who the cops attacked unprovoked. I don't know about that. Let's see. Carlene says, if you are white and right, then you are a stain on society and democracy. But if you are on the left and support this oppression insanity, then you are just misunderstood. Yeah, I mean, I really feel like there are just differing standards, and a lot of it is what the media chooses to focus on. And if the media isn't pointing out the blatant hypocrisy, then what's the motivation for politicians to acknowledge the blatant hypocrisy or to make sure that they're being morally consistent on these issues? If you're Bob Ferguson and you're getting away with, you know, the Seattle Times editorial board, which is arguably one of the most influential publications when it comes to people in the most populous city in the state deciding who to vote for, if you can do absolutely nothing to deal with an issue for years and years on end and make it worse, and then do one measly thing and the op-ed board praises you for it, then why would you try harder? Why would you try to be morally consistent? Why would you try to deal with crises? You wouldn't. All right, let's get...
But there are quite a few people saying Reichert needs to jump on these type of arguments. He does.
Where is Dave Reichert?
Where is he?
Where is Dave Reichert?
I know. It's been pretty quiet the last few weeks.
It's been absolutely quiet. And I know that mm-hmm. he has a lot of name recognition, so he doesn't have to, in the early stages, campaign as hard as someone like Semi Bird. But that doesn't mean you get to be asleep at the wheel.
No.
I mean, we've been doing more than Dave Reichert has been doing to try to raise awareness for shortcomings with Bob Ferguson. Why don't we just run for governor as a team? Dual governors. I mean, honestly, the man needs to be out actively speaking out about these things. I know that I'm not against, like, people on the right are like, we need a fighter. And I agree with that. Mm-hmm. I think you need a common sense fighter.
Yep.
But this is low hanging fruit. It's like just to point out the hypocrisy of it all and not to let the op-ed board get away with praising him when he doesn't deserve it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there is a... Well, I don't know how he's supposed to get out there. I don't think his stories will maybe get picked up quite as easily as Ferguson's in the Times. But I think he needs to be making an effort to call him out on some of this.
Right, to point it out. And then you point out this would have been three
examples.
Can't
wait for debates, if that's what you're planning on.
And it would have been three examples right in a row of, like, what is the op-ed board doing?
Right.
Are they, and again, whether you like it or not, they are influential. For some reason, The Stranger is too when it comes to their endorsements of the far left-wing nuts. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to who reasonable people in Seattle are going to vote for, the Seattle Times editorial board does have a lot of influence. And so it kind of freaks me out that somebody from his campaign isn't out there fighting the good fight and being like, are you guys already trying to prop up his campaign? Mm-hmm. You know, 12 months out from a primary? It's ridiculous. Okay. And I like Dave. I've been clear about that. That doesn't mean I'm not going to scrutinize the way he's campaigning or lack of campaigning.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Let's get to our closing sanity check, shall we? All right, so we've been talking about how Seattle has failed so far to adopt a drug possession law. While other cities have, the city of Everett's actually using theirs. They sent officers out to arrest people who wouldn't accept access to services who were openly using drugs in public. We loved it. We loved to see it. So remember how the Common Sense Council members in Seattle, they put forth a municipal proposal, and it got shot down, including by Andrew Lewis, the councilman for downtown. So it was like, okay, great. The city where the drug crisis is the worst still can't arrest people for using drugs blatantly out in the open. And then the mayor of Seattle came out and he's like, here's what we're proposing, although they haven't voted on it yet. And it was sort of meant to be this compromise between the council members who didn't like the idea of SPD arresting people for drug crimes, and a compromise between them and the people who are like, we have to do this. Our city's in crisis. People are dying on the streets. So anyway, I thought there was this interesting Como article, and it's just insane to me. I mean, I'm glad they're pointing this out, but it is such a level of insanity. So this is the headline from Como News. Council member sees more challenges in Seattle's yet to be adopted drug possession law. And one of the issues here is that the compromise version of the law that the mayor is championing that has not been voted on yet, it would make things very difficult for Seattle police, and it would prioritize treatment over arrest, but it would also force police to basically prove that the individual who's using drugs out in the open is posing a danger to other people. So it's not enough just to be using drugs out in the open. You'd also have to be a risk to other people. Here's the article, or here's a part of the story from Como.
What problems do you see in enforcing Seattle's proposed drug law?
Well, the first thing we need to do is get the state law compromise on our books here in Seattle. And talking to police officers, they are concerned that there will be some complexities on how they are being asked to be, you know, part social worker, part physician, part psychologist.
King County Jail is still under COVID protocols. Most misdemeanors cannot be bookable in King County Jail. But at the end of the day, those people are going to be back on the street within minutes.
Yeah. So there are multiple breakdowns that Como News points out, and that was Mike Solon of the Seattle Police Officers Guild. So one of them is the fact that, okay, if we clear the way for officers to arrest individuals for using drugs, are they going to be booked into jail or are they going to be turned away? And if they're turned away, then what good did we really just do? Because nobody's expecting those people to show back up for any sort of treatment program. The other one is that you're putting a lot of the assessment on police officers as to whether this person should be arrested. The mayor's office said that officers will be tasked with using their discretion when making case-by-case assessments, and officers would receive training on the department's expectations. So it's like, great, now you have an officer who has to decide as put on their social worker hat and be like, is it in the best interest to arrest this person or not arrest this person, and how will they benefit from it, you know, in their efforts to get better? But then that one is the key, that the mayor's proposal, again, this is from Como News, the mayor's proposal would only allow officers to arrest drug users if they present a threat of harm to others. What's the point? And who gets to judge what a threat of harm is? Clearly they present a threat of harm to themselves. But how can you judge unless they're out there, I guess, so high out of their mind that they're screaming at people, I'm going to kill you. But if you wait till they actually present a harm to other people and try to hurt them, then they've committed an additional crime and you can arrest them on that crime. So at the end of the day, what is the statute for around drug possession? That doesn't make any sense. The point to have a drug possession statute in municipal code is to deal with the drug crisis that we're facing. If a drug user assaults someone or commits another act of violence against someone, there's already laws on the book for that that have nothing to do with the substance abuse status of the person who committed the crime. So essentially what they're going to do is push through some really weakened version of state statute that allows them to do essentially nothing. And then we are right back to where we started, except Andrew Lewis in downtown Seattle can pat himself on the back, try to win his seat back and be like, see, we came up with a compromise version that's even better, and I care about dealing with the drug crisis, when he really doesn't. So I would encourage the Common Sense members of the Seattle City Council not to allow a weakened version of this to push through and to fight for one that actually has some teeth, because this is insane. All right, that has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving Common Sense a comeback. 10 minutes long? Nicole and I didn't even think we were going to have a show today. We're starting late. Again, we've had internet issues. We were just struggling this morning. So we had late show prep. And now look at us, 10 minutes over. It's like we're professionals.
It's like, just like it.
It's just like it. All right, sign up, undividedpod.com, undividedpod.com. Help us continue and grow this mission to give common sense a comeback. We'll see you on the live show tomorrow, and I promise I will not talk as quickly as I did today. Goodbye.